Welcome to Jesus Wars, a quest for the historical Jesus. In today's show, we have a new guest who's going to be sharing his thoughts. We met at a Facebook group called Historical Jesus, Higher Criticism, and Second Temple Judaism. So, Mr. Gaio, would you like to tell us about your interest in Jewish studies, historical Jesus, and these topics, and why is it relevant to discuss them as Jews?
Okay. All right. A lot there to unpack. Okay. So my interest in it comes like I have nominal Jewish ancestry. So, you know, I wasn't raised Jewish, but I have Jewish ancestry. My mother converted to Christianity when I was very young, and so I was raised in a home where like Christianity was partially like one of my parents was involved with it. So I grew up around, you know, I guess the teachings of Christianity and stuff. By the time that I was 8, I was beginning to ask questions. By the time I was 12, I'd read their Bible cover to cover twice. Well, I take that back. I read the Torah, the Tanakh, twice, and the New Testament once. I had a lot of problems with the New Testament that didn't agree with the Torah. And I would ask questions of the leaders, and, you know, in the end, they would usually tell me things like, you just have to have faith and just kind of believe in it. When I got old enough, though, I decided to kind of study things for myself, started going to libraries and whatnot. Eventually ended up going to Bible college. It was Christian Bible college at the time. I was studying theology, church history, the gospels, evangelism, stuff like that. And then, again, I would always bump heads with the professors, because I would point out the inaccuracies, the differences between the, and what they called the Old Testament and the New Testament. And it started to get to a point where a lot of the conversations were going, well, you probably should go in your own direction, because I wasn't towing the denominational party line and whatnot. And I guess as time grew, I became more and more interested in like what having some Jewish ancestry meant, what it meant to me. And for me, the Torah has always been part of my life. It's always spoke to me. I can't say the same about the New Testament. So I ended up deciding to go through a process of conversion. You know, there's some steps along the way. But in the process, you know, I did do a lot of studying and research into, you know, learning how to read Greek and read some of the text in Greek to see what they actually say for myself. You know, as I was going through conversion, I was learning more and more Hebrew. Between all the courses that I took in Bible college, and then when I was took some courses in yeshiva and Kollel and stuff like that, I was doing a lot of studies into Second Temple Judaism, the Dead Sea Scrolls, parting of the ways between Christianity and Judaism. And through my research, I felt like I started to find a kernel of truth there that it's maybe not, there is a consensus of scholars that kind of believe this way, but there's not necessarily a major consensus. You know, through my research, I came to the conclusion that all of the followers of Jesus, including Jesus himself, were Jewish and remain so. One of the things I kind of wanted to talk about today is how there is actual document evidence that the early community of Jesus, namely James and Peter, saw themselves within the traditional rabbinic structure. They make statements referring to the initiation according to Moses, the Great Assembly, things that we know refer to the Great Assembly that started in Babylonian captivity. And really it was the foundation of the Pharisaic movement, like the rabbinic movement kind of came out of that, the idea of rabbis and synagogues and stuff like that. But so yeah, my interest in that has grown over time. Studying, the formations of what eventually became, rabbinic Judaism and what became Christianity, and like the parting of ways and stuff like that. So that's how I could best summarize kind of my entrance into this, my interest in this. And then for me, and this has always been the case, and this is what kind of made me take a change in my journey, is I always held to the facts and the evidence, and I always like disregarded people's opinion about things. So when you see a piece of evidence, you take that and you should evaluate what you believe on that instead of trying to make that evidence conform to what you believe, which I think is what a lot of people do. And they talk about the difference between exegesis and eisegesis, searching for confirmation bias or trying to figure out like the historical kernel of truth. So I mean, for a while there, I had an extensive library of books on the historical Jesus, Second Temple Judaism, and just like a myriad of things. And then so that's kind of my story. Now, the second part, I believe you asked how that relates to Jews. And I don't know, my opinion about that is maybe a little different. The forums that I've been engaging with, like the one we met on, was more a dialogue with people in a journey of exploring what it means to leave Christianity and find truth that is different than what they're used to. So I wouldn't say my idea was like Jews need to have a view about Jesus, but as Christianity is one of the world's largest religions and it comes out of Christianity, it's helpful to understand it. And I think Amy Jill Levine makes a good idea of, in her book, The Misunderstood Jew, that having an interfaith dialogue and understanding each other is beneficial. Having a right understanding of the historical Jesus can give Jews the ability to answer people who want to make theological claims and try to advocate for adherence to Christianity over Judaism. So, in short, I think that would be my answer.
What I appreciate about you is that you were educating the members of our group, and there's always people with crazy theories, and there's always people who wanna, destroy one argument or the other. But you were very intellectually honest, showing how there are a few Jewish scholars who have, as neutral or as positive view of Jesus as possible based on the historical evidence. Versus this other group that I'm part of, where all they want to do is destroy Christianity, and it's silly. It's almost like people that are fighting over football or politics or something like that, where they demonize the other side, and they're not even willing to hear out what people are saying. And you mentioned that there are people who are pursuing truth, and now they're struggling with theological issues with Christianity, but is there a possibility to look at both Judaism and Christianity from an objective way and from a truth perspective, in the sense of, like, can we put both to the test and see where we end up at, versus are we coming up with an answer like Judaism is true, and if Jesus doesn't comply to what traditional Judaism is, then he's out, or the other way around, Christianity is already true, and if Judaism doesn't speak in high regard of Jesus, then is worthless. How do you stay balanced and are able to stay the course? Because I think that a lot of people don't even want to engage in these type of conversations because they become so hateful.
Well, a good sense of your own emotional intelligence and not engaging in toxic communication online, but that's kind of difficult. A lot of people engage in, classic, when an argument fails, they go to ad hominem attacks. They start, name calling, tearing you down, accusing you of things. For me, I'm just going to stick to the facts and always have an honest assessment of things, even in my own failures, my own argument. There was somebody I was engaging with on a similar forum, and we were talking about textual criticism of the New Testament and the historical Jesus, and then he starts going, well, Abraham and Moses weren't necessarily biblical figures. So, you know, I educated him that my view of the Torah is pretty much similar. I look at the document hypothesis that, you know, the four sources or five sources that went into the creation of the text. I mean, I take the same view of textual criticism and historical scholarship for the Tanakh, the Torah, and for the New Testament. There is a uniqueness between the two texts, which is different. There are scribal errors in both translations, but they found more consistency in the transmission of the Torah. And the difference is in the New Testament. And if we get into some of the you know, topics we kind of talked about going over today, we'll get into that. There's a unique difference with the New Testament where there's not just scribal errors, but there's intentional errors to add pericopes or stories in the New Testament that aren't in the earliest manuscripts and sometimes find themselves at different places in the later Greek manuscripts. So there was an intentional active effort to add theological claims to bolster, you know, their beliefs that is unique between the, you know, the scribal transmission of the two communities. But as far as between Jewish and Christian, I mean, I personally have a different view of things. And I don't necessarily, my view is that there is one God, but no religion has all the truth. And that, you know, within the Kabbalistic traditions within Judaism, the klipot, you know, the husk covers the netzosei Elohim, the divine light that's in all beings that you can find scattered throughout creation, and there's husks that cover it. So like people's beliefs and religious views, they might have some elements of truth. There's elements of Christianity that takes from the Torah and Judaism that has changed the Western world for the better. Now it's the Torah that they have taken and repurposed, added on additional things, but I believe it's the elements of Torah that has changed, you know, Western Europe and influenced, you know, a lot of the Western world. Some people say Judeo-Christian. I prefer like Judeo-Western values when we're talking about it. But there's been good that comes out of Christianity. And there are good people in Christianity. So, you know, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Just because there may be intentional efforts to, you know, change the text to say what they wanted to say doesn't mean they aren't good people who are going down this path. So I don't think you should ever demonize people, especially good people who their intentions are good, not to harm anyone. And I think the rabbis of the, you know, that period of parting of the ways where the rabbis started to grapple with and they started to talk about the idea of what's become known as the Noahide tradition or the Ger Toshav or Ger Sadik, that Gentiles don't necessarily, you know, that if they follow the seven commands, you know, of the Noahide covenant, they have a place in the world to come and they don't have to convert to Judaism. I think that was a way that the rabbis were starting to deal with this burgeoning movement that they were parting ways with, but still giving them kind of grace to be like, do their own thing. So I don't think it's beneficial for either community to say their way is right or wrong. Personally, for me, what makes sense is Judaism, and I can make a clear case as to why that makes sense for me. But I don't think demonizing somebody who believes different than you is beneficial.
So Are you familiar with the term Beshar or Besharim?
It's been a while. You'd have to refresh my memory on that one.
So, one way of interpreting the Bible that a lot of sectarian groups would do is that they would create their own interpretations that were applied to their leaders and their circumstances. So, the idea that the Jewish Christians or the early followers of Jesus were distorting Jewish texts to tell their story is something that gets thrown around a lot. But if you look at the Yahad, the Dead Sea Scroll community, and even the rabbis in the Talmud, they interpret things and they apply things in way that benefits their agenda. And everybody does it to greater or smaller extent, but I guess you could say that the Jewish followers of Jesus did it to the extreme, where every single passage pointed to Jesus. And there are very strange applications of prophetic passages that would be the first place where anti-missionaries would try to, debunk their claims. But if you look at what other people were doing, it's like they were the Yahad was calling the Sadducees, but they had issues with the Sadducees because of the way they were treating the temple, and then they had issues with the Perushim, with the Pharisees, as well. And then in later rabbinic interpretation, you see that too, where they'll take a small passage and they'll make it into a huge mountain, and try to apply it, or like almost like force it into the text. Do you think that that's something that we should consider? And also, I don't know if you are familiar with the book called the Jewish Annotated New Testament.
Yeah.
There they say that a lot of the passages that I have problems with in the book of Hebrews and things like that, they have the interpretation is almost a version that is only used by certain groups. So, there's issues with Septuagint, the way that it was translated and almost like interpreted. And then there's also the Aramaic version of that. So either whoever wrote that book was only grabbing stuff that would help their case, or that was the tradition that they were familiar with, so they applied it in support of their cause. So is it really Do you see ever in the Jewish community where they try to make such a strong case that their interpretation is so correct and every other interpretation is wrong, when we just studied the stuff critically, we know that everybody was reinterpreting and reapplying and creating their story based on what they thought was right for them at that time, versus throwing everybody out who they don't agree with and saying, well, their interpretation is heretical, but ours is right, when we know that everybody was doing that at the same time.
Minor and macro level, on a micro and macro level. So on the small level, because at some point, the things that Christians misunderstood about the Greek Septuagint and their misunderstandings about those texts and the influence of Roman culture, the writings of Paul, it became something completely different than Jewish tradition, so it was no longer within the Jewish dialogue. Are there inter-Jewish arguments between the different communities, of the first century, the Essenes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Zealots, the Zechariah, all the ones, there was, of course, there was differences and different application. However, when you're talking about prophetic prophecies, one, every text has a culture and a tradition that it's written in. Who was it written to? Who was it written by? And sometimes, and the reason, like the sages say, to translate is to lie. There are sayings that make sense in the original language, but when you translate it, it doesn't make sense. For example, and this is just I'm watching the NPR broadcast, and it's talking about immigrant stories about people coming over from Mexico into the US, and the Comic-Con Museum here in San Diego has featured a Latin American comic artist. And there's a lot of the stuff is written for a Spanish audience, and a lot of the idioms and the jokes make sense in Spanish, but it's translated in English, and then those jokes that made sense in Spanish don't make sense in English. So when the language of the Torah was originally Hebrew, and then you have it translated into Greek for the Septuagint, and then you remove that from the period of time that happens, and over time, the Hellenization of the Jews. By the time we get to the second and third century, where Christianity is heavily influenced by the Roman culture, linguistics, ideas, the entire New Testament, for a majority of what we base our text in, is from Greek. And a lot of the idioms and stuff that you find in there are influenced by the Greek cult, the Roman culture, but it's written in Greek. And so there is a loss of translation between the original and what we have. For the New Testament, what we have are copies of copies. And the earliest intact New Testament we have is from the Codex Sinaiticus, which is from, like, they date it to 325 to 380, somewhere in that period. After the Nicene Council, around the Nicene Council, we don't have an intact, New Testament before that. That's 300 years after, Jesus passed. And if Jesus spoke in Aramaic and he went to synagogues, he would have read the scriptures in Hebrew. And then we're having a text that's 300 years later in Greek. There's a loss of translation between the origin and whatever has been received or given to the early, the Catholic Church in the third and fourth century.
Have you looked into the idioms used in the New Testament? Because there's a document written by Dr. Ron Mosley, which he shows that if you do a comparison of the amount of idioms with in the Greek, that they're all Semitic in nature. So even though it's a Greek text, the like you said, the phrases that Jesus uses are usually misunderstood, because in the Hebrew and the Greek, there's like sometimes it rhymes or it has like a colloquial aspect to it. So it could be that we're reading it with a Greek perspective, just because not only is it Greek, but it has been interpreted by Greco-Roman thinking for hundreds of years. But if we go back and we look at it in the Greek, in the Hebrew, or in the Aramaic, it's more Semitic and more in line with Hillel and Shammai and other proto-rabbis of that time. Is that your perspective when you were sharing Giza Bermesh, Imogil Levine, and other Jewish scholars who have looked into the Jewish aspect of Jesus? Do you feel that they have kind of reclaimed him as a first century Jew who actually was within the context of that culture, and even the things he said make more sense within that almost like worldview and frame of mind?
Well, I think we'd have to establish a couple things. One, who the historical Jesus is. Through textual criticism, what text is authentic? Because if you're just taking the New Testament as a whole, the scholarship consensus is that the New Testament is not historically accurate, and does not accurately depict what Jesus would have taught. But that's when you take it as a whole. Really, to get to that point, to answer that question, I think, a few things need to be established first. Geza Vermes says the historical Jesus is a much more elusive figure than the Jesus of the Gospels. So the Gospels, if we look at how the Gospels were made, or at least the common theories of that, Mark is the primary gospel, the one that was written first, or that we have the earliest manuscripts of. And it seems that Matthew and Luke were written as a response to Mark, and that Matthew and Luke may have shared what they call the theoretic, or the Q text, or the Q gospel. The source, they have source material that Mark didn't have. So, like, first, and you've probably already covered this on your channel. I didn't get a chance to watch a lot of the videos in there, but when we're talking about the historical Jesus, one, the Gospels aren't historical documents. Pamela Eisenbaum and Alan Siegel, they believe the New Testament Gospels aren't reliable, and I believe a majority of the other scholars that I mentioned, Boyerin, Nanos, even Gezi Vermesh, would all agree that it's not a historically accurate book. They are theological works that were written decades after Jesus' death. They're written by people that didn't know Jesus, and they were heavily influenced by theology. Mark being the first gospel, but it's considered that the seven works of Paul that we think were most likely written by Paul were written before the gospels, and therefore the gospels are written out of that theological framework. Now, that doesn't mean, and that's why the search for the historical Jesus becomes like figuring out what sayings are authentic to Jesus and what were theological things that the early church or the believers that started to believe a new theory of Jesus were trying to put into the text. And so that's what the search, you know, the Jesus seminar and the search for the historical Jesus was really to figure out. What, because textual criticism, the purpose of textual criticism is to say, you know, what is the authentic text? What are the errors? What was the author originally trying to convey, right? You know, when we look at New Testament scholarship, at least when it comes to like the historical Jesus, there's only two things that scholars agree on. One, that Jesus was baptized, and two, that he was crucified. When you look at the Mark, the primacy of Mark, well, the last portion of the Mark, all the accounts after resurrection was added onto the book. So you asked about the scholarship within the Jewish community when it comes to Jesus, and the consensus within the Jewish community that with that those who tackle the text, if you want to talk about a Jewish reclamation of Jesus, is that he was a Jew. He lived as a Jew. He went to synagogue. You know, I'm trying to think. I don't know if I've seen scholarship that said he kept kosher, but I'm pretty sure he did. He observed the festivals and everything. I mean, there were, you know, he talked about various festivals within the gospel, so that was within there. He taught his message, and then he was crucified. Outside of that, then you're moving into the theological Jesus. So if you're talking about the post-resurrection accounts, the theology of Paul, that is all separate from the historical Jesus and where I would place Jewish scholarship on the historical Jesus.
So, I wanted to discuss the controversial accusations made by certain individuals. And in our show, we have kind of tried to dismiss some of them as almost like superstitions or just ridiculous attacks that sometimes don't even make any sense. So just like Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, I believe that the passages in the Talmud that mention some type of Yeshu character are either polemics that are based on hearsay and limited information that they had at that time, or they're historical, like almost like gaffes where they just mixed a bunch of stuff together and they created an enemy that is from like different time periods. or an issue they had, and they put it on this Jesuit character. So I asked you before the show on this idea of Jesuit Ben Pandera or Ben Stada, and so this guy on Facebook was saying that it was actually a separate individual, but it was kind of like the individual that either became the Christian Jesus or like some other version or something, and that he was the son of a Roman soldier, and that his mom was a harlot, and that he practiced magic and all this stuff. Do you think that bringing up stuff like that is even helpful? And is there any historical relevance to bring up all these different Jesuses that are in opposition to the one that even the one that historians can even discuss?
I would say it's informative to the so the consensus would be that the theological Jesus was a myth that was an amalgamation of various messianic stories of Jewish adherents in the first century who wanted to become king of the Jews and dispose the Greeks. Jesus wasn't the only one. So part of the theory is that the stories of Jesus are an amalgamation of those various texts. So now if we're talking about the polemics within the Talmud, they seem to be polemics, and they're used as polemics against the Jesus of the New Testament. And they may as well be speaking to various stories that were pulled from various messianic adherents to the in the first century. But there is not strong evidence for it. It's very weak. James Tabor's book on the topic, though, he does a really good job of making the case that there was a Roman soldier, Pantera, that lived in Tiberias and was in that vicinity near that time. He makes a good case that such a person probably existed. Therefore, the story in the Talmud about Jesus, Pantera, and Mary may have existed. I mean, even the Jesus Ossuary book that talks about the potential find of a Jesus Ossuary that includes Mary and Joseph, and it seems like all the names line up. It's interesting. I would say that any of that stuff is not definitive. Does it matter in the end? It's a polemic argument. It does speak to the various messianic stories that may have made up what came to be known as the Jesus of the theological, of what became the focus of the Christian message. But again, that goes back to one, I feel like establishing the historical Jesus, who he is, and then who he is within Judaism. Once you establish the historical Jesus, what that is within Judaism, then all of those other conversations, can start to make sense a little bit more. But a lot of times, sometimes they get off in the minutiae of things. There's no way to prove that, Pantera was Jesus' father or not. It's an interesting conversation to be had. Why is it there? And I think it's really interesting that James Tabor at least found evidence that a person by that name was a centurion in the first century. So outside of that, I can't say much about it.
We're gonna run into the break in 5 minutes, but
All right.
can you, as a Jew, or would you ever be open to the idea of Jesus being a holy man that not only was misunderstood? Well, to say that he was misunderstood is to put a lot on the situation. So he's saying all this stuff about God, he's saying all this stuff about Torah. And then some crazy followers made him into a messiah. But what if, like, Hugh Schoenfeld said that, like, he actually believed that he was a messiah, or he had a messianic dream or expectation, and then just like every prophet and every possible leader who has something to say in the Jewish world. He died with his beliefs. He died with his claiming something or asking people to do teshuva, repentance, or to get closer to God. And so his aspirations to the messiahship weren't fulfilled. Is that the same as someone being a fake messiah, whereas someone who, like Sabbatai Zvi or some other character who has this very high view of himself and is willing to destroy everything to prove who they are? Do you think that he could be a failed messiah, someone that if it would have worked out, he could have reached that goal? Or is that too much to put as it's almost like another form of theological speculation, kind of like what Paul did?
It's theological speculation for sure. Svi, he converted to Islam at the end there. He was all over the place. So I have questions, number one, about the apocalyptic and messianic aspirations of Jesus. How much of that was something he believed or was added later? It is possible. I don't see him as a false messiah, but definitely failed. Within the context of Judaism, he failed to fulfill the most basic Messiah, King, Mashiach. I mean, Messiah was never meant to be a savior in a spiritual sense, because the idea comes from Moshe, who delivered the Jewish people from Egypt, and eventually through the 40 years in the wilderness, they got their own land. Mashiach, in the vein of Messiah, or Mashiach, I just said it twice, but anyways, in the vein of Moshe, Mashiach was to deliver the people of Israel from captivity. The Romans were in charge there, and the ideas in the first century is they wanted a Messiah, a king, who would come in and establish the kingdom of David. At the time of Jesus, the temple was standing, so you can't rebuild it when it's standing. But you would ingather the Jews and you would establish world peace, and Jerusalem would be the capital of Israel, and Romans wouldn't be ruling, was the aspiration at the time. So as far as that, Jesus failed. And the idea of a soul savior and like these other ideas that were added later, burning fiery hell for eternity that you must be saved from, resembles more Hades than like the torture that they have in the Greek pantheon, and the random stuff that happens for eternity to people there, and doesn't follow the Jewish view of what Gehenna is, where it's a purification and then the soul goes to God after purification. There's this fear that was created through hell, and you need savior, and then the doctrine of original sin, you take good people, you tell them they're bad, you tell them they're going to go to hell, you need Jesus, all of a sudden people are ready to sign up, so that's going to sell pretty quickly. And then you take away the Jewish trappings and you tell people, hey, you can stay as you are, you just need Jesus, then all of a sudden it's a very palatable religion. I wouldn't say that that's the religion that Jesus was advocating. And if we're moving back to, like, I want to kind of lay the groundwork with the historical Jesus, within Judaism, the only things we know is he lived Jewishly, was baptized, and he died. There was no virgin birth. He wasn't resurrected.
I know you were going into the theological claims of the Gospels, but I have to push back on a couple of things. So I believe the idea of Gehinnom becoming a purgatory style purification thing is a later concept. And then the issue of the Messiah being only a king can be disputed because, in the Dead Sea Scrolls they talk about two Mashiachs, and one is a priestly one, and the other one is one is from Aaron and the other one's from David. And that's where the idea later on comes that there's two Mashiachs. The reason I bring up the concept of the fatal messiah is that one of my professors said that not only was the idea of Messiah ben Joseph developed in the Talmud to kind of like try to bring Jewish Christians back into the fold, sorry, to try to bring Jewish Christians back into the fold, but there was also the concept of being failed in the sense of any, like he was a Kabbalist, so he said that anybody has the potential to be the Messiah. So that Jesus was one of the many contenders, and it was because he couldn't find anything in the teachings of Jesus that it was foreign to Judaism. Now, if we talk about the virgin birth, if we talk about the passages that have been interpreted as him claiming to be divine, stuff like that, of course, all of these things come into issue. But from, you mentioned he lived a Jewish life. He was anointed by John the Immerser, and he was killed. Are those things impossible for a Messiah to experience? Because when people come up with this like very narrow view that the only Messiah is the Messiah that Maimonides described, they're not taking into consideration that in every generation before Jesus and after Maimonides and in between, everybody was claiming to be the Messiah in one way or another. Not everybody, but there was quite a few guys, and they were all claiming to be the Messiah based on the circumstances. So there was times where they thought the Messiah was going to come and destroy the Muslims, and there was times they thought that he was going to destroy the Christians, and there was times that different contenders and different people would take people into the desert, and then they would all die or something. So it's almost like it's you were talking about the apocalyptic. So there comes to a point where that's what creates a problem. If you think that God is not doing what he's supposed to, then there's people who want to bring it about. So the way they bring it about is by getting into this very conflictive and almost confrontational battle. And that's what the Essenes were doing in their own way. So do you think that he was, like some people have described him as a revolutionary or someone who was pushing the envelope and trying to like create conflict either with the other Jews or with the Romans? Do you think that that's possible, or is that wishful thinking? Some people trying to make him into like a Bar Kokhba type of figure.
Well, there's a lot in there. Okay, so the two Mashiachs, the claim in the New Testament is that he would be of the line of David, not of Aaron, so that would preclude him from priestly service. For the Messiah to come after, he'd have to be of the lineage of Aaron. So I think that the history would go against that. Now, if you want to talk about what happened after Jesus died and how the myth making began and how the early followers of Jesus, the Hellenized Jews who began to kind of go their own way, and a growing number of Gentiles who adhered to that, how do you come to terms with the fact that your leader is dead? And if the gospel accounts are true, that he said, some of you living will, see me coming on the clouds kind of thing. That didn't happen. So how do you come to terms with that? So a lot of the apocalypticism seems to be revisionism to make sense of that and then make the message continue to be relevant. I would argue that's not necessary to make the words of Jesus relevant. There's a lot to unpack here. You've mentioned the sayings of Jesus reflecting the things that other rabbis have said or Jewish teachers have said. If we're getting back to the historical Jesus and the best attested sayings of Jesus, I would agree that the sayings that we can most likely attest as historical, and they are not necessarily, you can find them in the New Testament, but if you read the entire Matthew through John, you're going to have stuff that's not. So if we're going back to the attested sayings of Jesus, I would say Jesus was not revolutionary in any sort, any way. He actually seems to be, pretty middle of the road. I don't see him being too controversial. Now, like the debates between Hillel and Shammai and some of the things, like a lot of the stuff kind of pans out within Jewish tradition, the same kind of conversations have been had. So I don't necessarily see him as a revolutionary in that sense. I see him as falling within sayings that you would hear other, Jewish teachers or rabbis of that time say. So I don't see Jesus as a revolutionary in as much of the message that we can attest to him. Now, did he claim to be Mashiach? That's what he was crucified for. He was crucified as the king of the Jews. So whether he said it or his followers believed it, there was that belief that he was going to Jerusalem to establish himself as king. And that is what he was crucified for. So I would say that there was that belief, whether it was by Jesus himself or his followers, that he was going to Jerusalem to establish his rulership. That didn't pan out for him. So, but I don't really think Jesus was a revolutionary. I think he was kind of average when you look at his sayings. Like, I mean, honestly, what can you point out that he said that's greatly contradicted or in opposition to things you can find in the Talmud?
Well, people claim that he was a physical revolutionary, like someone who wanted to battle and war. And we're going to do a review of Reza Aslan's book, which has
Okay.
more holes than Rabbi Boteach's book. But I want to talk about Paul
Been a while since I read that book. Yeah, that's
because
well, I
Paul.
mean, Jesus did have zealots and Zechariah within his movement. Now, I mean, because Simon was called the zealot and Judas Iscariot is that's Greek, the Hebrew, he was a Zechariah. So Judas was a Zechariah. But there were Essenes in his community, in his group of followers. There's Pharisees. I don't see evidence that Jesus was a zealot, but he did make statements, like he, came to bring a sword and divide a mother from a father. Or I'd have to go. I don't know the language of that text right now. I have to look at it. But he, basically said he would divide a family. Sorry, my phone's going off. It was. Anyways, I don't necessarily see him as a zealot, but he had people that were amongst his movement that were.
So, have you ever tried to compare Paul to Philo or to other Hellenist Jews who, even Maimonides has been accused of being a sellout because he was using Greek ideas to describe Judaism? Do you think that it's a possibility if we put aside all the hatred towards Paul for whatever people think he did, that he was a mystically minded Jew who incorporated Greek ideas to get his message across, and that somehow it had the unforeseen consequences of being completely distorted to make him an antinomian enemy of the Torah and an obsessive person about Jesus, where, like you were saying, that without Jesus, everybody's out, and that Jesus becomes allegiance to Jesus becomes the only ticket to parties or heaven, and that, he could have been a fanatical Jew, or he could have been a very staunch, adherent to the message of Jesus. But why make him into this paganized heretic or apostate that becomes like the enemy of the Jewish people when he has positive things to say about Jews and Torah, and then his criticism, and then that could also be interpreted in so many different ways, and it's only been interpreted as anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic throughout history.
Well, I'm not sure all those statements made by Paul can be attributed to Paul. We don't have any original authorship from Paul. We have writings about Paul or writings that are said to be from Paul. If we had a first century manuscript that was authored by Paul, then we would know for sure what Paul said. Just like if we had writings from, you know, Peter or James or any of those that survived from the first century, we could say what they actually said. We have copies of copies of copies that are hundreds of years later. So to definitively say that these things came out of Paul's mouth, I mean, we have to prove that. So it's not necessarily true that. You know, whether or not it was things Paul said or it was things that was put in his mouth centuries later when the Catholic Church took these stories and made it into what it was. I mean, it was a process. I mean, over time, the story started to divulge and change. But as Orthodoxy grew, what became Orthodoxy, what became Catholicism, what became Christianity, they started focusing more and more on certain texts. But within those texts, they added things, they changed things. You know, for example, when we're talking about textual criticism, there's the passage in John 1:18 that the older manuscripts say unique son, the later manuscripts say unique God. In Corinthians, there's additions about women being silent in church that's at different places in the text. It's not, you know, there's manuscripts that have it at an early place, and that's 40 verses later in another text. You know, that there's things that, not sure if we had the original manuscripts, we could say for sure. So I don't know if everything that is within the Pauline epistles came from Paul. If you want me to make a summary based on what's in them, that's a different question. Based on what's in the Pauline epistles, I don't see his view of Jesus, and I don't see his view of Jude. Okay, so the claim is made that he's a student of Gamaliel, but I don't see his teachings aligning with that. I see more of a Hellenistic Jewish influence. And I would put, you know, Paul's writings more in a Gnostic framework where it's based in knowledge. And that was the difference between James and Paul. James said salvation is essentially by works, and Paul says it's by believing in Jesus. It's having this knowledge that's going to save you. That's more of a Gnostic idea. I don't see, if we look within the Jewish mystic tradition, I don't see Paul as a honestly, it feels very much different than like if you're studying Tanya or Musar tradition or various mystical traditions within, I mean, even the Kabbalah. I don't see Paul's work within the mystical tradition. He seems to have more Stoic, Hellenistic, Gnostic ideas than I just wouldn't put him within the mystic tradition. I don't see enough support for that idea.
Well, we want to thank you for your time, and we appreciate you educating people. It seems like you have a lot of knowledge and a lot of information to share with the people in that Facebook group where I met you. And it's important that the people have like the whole picture. We see people that they find some information and they cling to it, and that's the only thing that they incorporate into their knowledge. So seems like you have researched everything thoroughly and, you know, try to navigate all these concepts. So if in the future we would like to have you back, and I don't know if you want to refresh your memory on Reza Aslan's book, because I have my own theories. I actually was in contact with him about his dissertation about the Book of Mark, and then he had another thesis paper that he did about terrorist groups in the Middle East, and I think he like fused them together to make that book, because there's something about that book that he's trying to convey, and it takes some sophistication to find. But here at the Jesus Wars, we want to give everybody as much information as possible so they can make their own decisions, and we appreciate your contribution to our show.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I did want to respond to one thing if you have a moment that talking about apocalypticism and zealots and stuff like that. You mentioned it earlier, and there's this danger that happens anytime somebody becomes very apocalyptic. And I think that Reza Aslan kind of deals with it in his book, and you kind of mentioned it, is that anytime people have moved into that apocalyptic, like we are seeing Messiah now, we're going to make this happen, people tend to move into violent extremism. So, I mean, that's an issue that's kind of played itself out through history. But
And
yeah,
I would like to discuss with you further about hyperbolic language, where people assume that he was talking about the end and he was talking about apocalyptic stuff. And I think he was eschatological, not apocalyptic. And there's been different books have been written about that, but that's for another show. But again, thank
man.
you.
Anyways, I thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. And yeah, we can do this again.
Definitely take care.
All right, have a good one.